Accession number 10420, reel 18.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 18. You were talking about the Home Guard, Colonel.
Yes. This was a Home Guard exercise which did, in fact, take place within the first few days of March. The Home Guard themselves provided 10 paratroopers. I can't remember quite where the paratroopers had to get to. Anyhow, be that as it may, they were Hemioc Home Guard, and the paratroopers failed in their exercise. And, of course, the Home Guard were absolutely delighted, and I gave them appropriate praise. And it encouraged them, and they became more and more enthusiastic. Well, then, continuing the program of training, we did a signal exercise, I remember, and I think I wasn't commanding at the time. Anyhow, it came to a very speedy end because the signal officer fell off his motorcycle and nearly removed half his ear. The carriers, our brain carriers, used to go and fire, do field firing exercises, and I always thought that it was wrong that the carrier platoon should be drawn from the MT section. I still feel that you wanted in those days to get the best chaps, never mind whether they could drive a vehicle of any kind, get them into the carriers, train them to drive a carrier and train them how to use the carriers, how a carrier should be used in war. But there was always the, you drew them from the MT because they knew how to drive. I thought that was all wrong. But
at this juncture, Colonel, could you tell me what the role of the carrier was supposed to be?
Go and watch, or on a flank, or watch ground. They could creep up behind a ridge, and the chaps could get out and watch, and that's what they did in the desert. They could rather make a cavalry charge and perhaps capture a lorry or two, which again they did in the desert, I remember. Set traps in a lane or in a field or somewhere like that, in a field waiting for the enemy to come down. They couldn't do much. They weren't used as tanks, but they were very useful in all sorts of different kinds of country. To watch in the desert, they were certainly used to watch and look unseen. A track perhaps being used to cross the desert by the enemy, that sort of thing.
What size of crew did it have?
Three. I think it was three. One, two, three. Three or four.
And that would be the driver?
The driver. The chap in front had a Bren gun and two chaps in behind. Of course, they're not used now. They're things of the past. There is one in the regimental museum. But anyhow, I found them useful, and I think other people did the same. And every Sunday, too, I used to hold platoon commanders' conferences. The young officers, when they came to the battalion, I found were appallingly weak on man management. They never knew what to do with wet clothes, taking steps to get the troops' clothes dried when they got back into billets. Didn't look at the boots to see whether they were worn out or not. Didn't see that the chaps had bars, and didn't see whether the food was good, and didn't see how the chaps spent their leisure, or didn't see how they ensure that their laundry was going off properly to be washed. And I used to hold conferences of this sort of thing on most Sundays. It always struck me that if they'd been taught more of man management before they came to the battalion, they would have been a good deal more useful as young officers.
Did you find that they did overcome this with your...
Oh, yes, of course.
And were you happy with the quality of the officers you were getting?
Well, we got one or two pretty good stumas, and they didn't last very long. No names, no petrol, but there were one or two. But on the whole, they weren't bad, and they became good officers. It did strike me that they could have been taught better before coming to a battalion. Of course, it applied whatever unit they went to, the same thing applied. I used to hold these conferences to try and drive it home. Then we had another brigade exercise towards the end of March. I was second in command there because second embarkation leave had started, and Sammy Battiscombe, the second in command, had gone on leave. And on the 26th of March, we had brigade exercise number two, and we went and occupied an empty camp, a place called Willerton, which I think is on the north coast of Devon, in the area of St. Audrey's. And it went well, that exercise. I know we occupied this summer camp on the North Devon coast. And I know when I had a moment and I went to turned in to go to sleep during the course of the exercise, I wondered who'd occupied the room, little sort of cabin place in the more happier days of peace. But the camp was only looked after by a military policeman and a few Jewish and Polish pioneers. There was a farmer there who was somewhat annoyed with me and Ergie Wilmot when we went through his farmyard, but he piped down. He actually gave me one, if not two, glasses of sherry, which I thought was rather nice of him after he'd been so upset by us walking through his farmyard. And then at the end of March, I came home from my second embarkation leave, and we anticipated moving to the port on the 2nd of May. It was only a week's leave, but it was my last home leave before, in fact, going abroad. And very soon as I came back, we had yet one more a lecture, which we were always having. They were based really on security over the wireless. That was what they were trying to drive home. The signal officer who was giving this particular exercise was a schoolmaster or not schoolmaster, instructor in a Borstel. And he treated us all just as if we were Borstel inmates. I went and had lunch in about the middle of April with my old friend Commander Adams for yet another home guard exercise. Now this would be for the Samford, Peveril and Holberton detachment of Home Guard. And it was a really simple exercise. 10 paratroopers provided by the Hemiok Home Guard again, I think, had to get a disused mill, get into possession of that. And the whole exercise was frustrated by a butcher boy who was so inquisitive that he was wondering what on earth was happening, and he set the local home guard on the trail and gave the whole show. The whole thing collapsed, and the paratroopers never got to their destination of the mill. By now, the new brigadier had taken over, and of course, we knew we were going overseas, and it was anticipated that our move to the port would be on the 2nd of May. However, as usual, the move was postponed once more. Not for very long, but it was postponed, and we had to unpack all the bags and the crates and what have you. Well, again now, we're on the 1st of May. I had to take part as a president for a court-martial, just a general court, a field general court-martial. That's a lower grade court-martial. Of the CO's batman, Aubrey Fletcher, again prosecuted it, if I remember rightly. And the CO had found that his batman was carrying on with a maid in his billet. How he did it, I don't quite know, but he went into the CO went into the maid's bedroom and found his batman's trousers hanging behind the maid's door. Well, the batman ran off home without leave, had a row with his wife, and went off searching for his girlfriend, who'd also been dismissed. I can't remember the details of what happened or what punishment we meted out, but again, we tried to conduct it as fair as possible. I'd had an earlier court-martial, which really did disturb me very much. I can't remember now who or what the offence was, who was charged or what the offence was. Oh, yes, I do remember. It was a youngish officer who'd taken a vehicle without leave, and had been involved in an accident. There had been a court of inquiry, and he'd been absolved. And it rather seemed to me that it was very unfair, and I looked it up in the appropriate section of the Act, and I felt that he shouldn't have been charged a second time. However, the Deputy Judge Advocate General on this occasion, and I was defending, was a chap called Manningham Buller, a well-known counsel, who was determined to get a conviction. And I thought he was grossly improper in pressing for a conviction when he only had to advise the court. He wasn't a prosecuting officer. The I think the prosecuting officer was Aubrey Fletcher again, and I was so disgusted at this Manning and Bullitt's behaviour. Incidentally, the chap was only admonished and had to pay £10 towards the £8 damages that had been done. But I was so really annoyed over the whole way Manning and Buller went on that I wrote to the staff captain of this chap's brigade, and he was a green heart, I think, and so we won 5-0 brigade. And that staff captain happened to be in the court and heard the whole proceedings. And he too backed me up, and he wrote a letter, and I forwarded my letter of complaint to higher authority. It went to the DAAG of the division, and I don't think anything happened to Manning and Buller. I believe my letter was lost. And the DAAG of the division, of course, was Tranmere, Lord Tranmere, Turton, the MP for Morton, and Thirsk.
What was the constitution of a court-martial, and the balance between the civilian and the military?
There was no civilian. They were all, Manning Buller would be a soldier. He was well known on in later life. He was a barrister. But he went to such extremes to try and persuade the court that my client, or your client if you like to call him, should be punished. But he shouldn't. He should just balance the thing, just like a judge does in a civilian court. He doesn't say jury, you must find this chap guilty. But that's what Manning and Buller were trying to do to the tribunal, which is three officers. And the president of the court was Colonel Drivers, who was the CRASC, and he too complained about Manning and Buller's behavior. Anyhow, after that, I wrote to Turton or Tranmere, or whatever he's called, and said, please, I want to have nothing more to do with court martials. And I didn't, except that I had to sit on one on board the Dutch Richmond, and I had to take the summary of evidence of rather an unpleasant one in the desert. And I never touched a court martial again, simply because everybody knew I was a lawyer and had a certain amount of experience. But I was now a soldier, and I'm damned if I was going to be involved in the law when I was a company commander. And hopefully, hoping to become a second in command. Well, now we're getting on now to just before we were going abroad. On the 2nd of May, I remember David Joy, well, he was having our MO, and he had them throughout all this time, skin inspections. He was a delightful chap, David Joy, rather plump and fat and jolly, and he was a very keen ornithologist, and he and I used to go out for walks looking for different kind of birds when we had a moment to spare. And I remember, too, I went to a local house and asked if I could fish in the River Calm, because it was a good trout stream, and they said I could, somewhat grudgingly, I think, but I think they were a little suspicious. And I know that when I was fishing one day, I saw on the bank opposite a kingfisher going in and out of its nest. And I also remember seeing a sedge warbler, which I don't see very frequently up in this part of the world. But then, of course, as I say, the embarkation had been put off, and there was fresh news of our departure. What was so intriguing, it was so extraordinary, was the fact that we had to change the numbers painted on all the our kit and the ship's number and the colours. You had to put splashes of three different kinds of colours, and this one was red, yellow, red. And if you go to the museum, you can see they look brown now, but they were red, yellow, red on my kit bag in my Jeep and on all the kits in my Jeep that's in the museum. Well, we'll have to alter that. And then it had to be, no, you won't. And we had to alter the ship's number, F-17, and it was on, and then it was out. It was to be F-5, and then it went out, and F-17, I think, went in again. We were doing that the whole time. And, of course, we were told that the Fifth Gloucesters were going to take over from us, but no, the Fifth Gloucesters didn't take over from us. The Ninth Somerset Light Infantry took over, which I think must have been one of Horbelicia's new units. They didn't know anything at all, but they were a very pleasant lot of indeed. And on the 18th of May, of course, we'd been told now, I think I said we were going on the 3rd, but on the 18th of May was our last Sunday in the British Isles, in the country. And I read the second lesson, which was the famous verses in the Ephesians, "Finally, my brethren, put on the whole armor of God." I used to read the second lessons when the vicar's son, the vicar incidentally was a man called Hubert Chalk, the vicar's son wasn't at home. He was at Marlborough, his public school, but had won a prize for reading the lessons in the school chapel. And therefore he, when he was at home, always took my place and read the second lesson. And very good he was too. That was our last Sunday in England. We used to have these Sunday parades every Sunday. This particular Sunday, the whole company was there, and the whole village always turned out to see us march back from church. We had bugles, and I used to take the salute, or if I wasn't there, the senior officer would take the salute on the tiny little village, sloping village green, outside battalion headquarters, which was based in a house in the village, looking down the village street. And all the villagers watched. And before this particular Sunday, our last Sunday, I remember the CO sent down to the, I think it was called Grantson's, was the house, big empty house which was we were billeted in, sent me a message down congratulating on the turnout of the company. He thought it was so smart, the whole march from the church to the billet. Well, then the next day, the Monday, I went and had my last meal, dined for the second time with my hosts, two Clark brothers, these two old men who lived in quite a different world to what was happening around them. They also had with them General Sir Travis Clark, who was the Quartermaster General, his very large wife and daughter, They had two sons who were, one was at school, and I think one was at university. Their London home had been bombed, and that's why they came down here from time to time. I used to come home back from my billet, from the battalion headquarters, officers' mess, which was in the Masonic Hall in the village, right at the very far end of the village. I used to come back at night, and I didn't go straight up to my bedroom. I thought it was rather rude. I used to go into the billiard room where these two old men were sitting with their feet up on a cushion and their shoes off in front of the fire. One wore a little sort of skull cap. They both wore great coats. They couldn't talk about anything. They really didn't realize what was, I don't think really deeply realized what was going on. Alfred, the younger, just used to go about. He might have been a shopkeeper in the village. The house was an Adams house on a little little mound. It had no garden. There were three household staff, three women in the house. I think then there was an outside driver, chauffeur, or groundsman, or something like that. But there were no gardens. They were mostly paddocks and park all the way around. It was a dull house. There was no electric light, barring, I think, in one room. When it was time to go to bed, Lady Clark came in from the drawing room. She was dressed in full evening regalia, and so was her daughter. And she would say it was time to go to bed. Alfred would douse the fire, and we'd all troop up to bed. I slept in a four-poster, it was with feather mattresses and feather pillows. I think I've mentioned, I did ask if I could stay in bed one day after I'd been inoculated. They did, one of the maids did in fact bring me breakfast, which was so nice.
As embarkation comes, did you find all these delays just frustrating, changing?
Yes, we did.
How did the morale of the troops?
They took it all in good heart. They were so used to it that they rather expected it. But it was annoying painting out and painting in all the packing cases and kit bags and all the rest. But anyhow, that was on the 19th I had my last meal.